the button, but it's not ready yet, so give me a second. Computer's being a bit slow today. Very slow. Let me try it again. Okay. It has started. Okay, well, hello. This is Linda Binns with Harmony Inside and Out, and I'd like to welcome everybody on the call. And this evening, I'm talking to Elaine Williams, who is the author of a really fascinating, interesting book called A Journey Well Taken, Life After Loss. And it's a very personal story about Elaine's husband, his illness and subsequent death, and then how Elaine coped with that and how she has moved on from that over the last few years. So really looking forward to talking with Elaine today. So welcome, Elaine, and thanks for being with us on the call this evening.
Hi, Linda, and thank you for inviting me.
Oh, you're welcome. Elaine, would you share a little bit about your background just for our listeners so they know a little bit about you and your history?
Well, I'm currently 51 years old, and I had been married for 20 years. My husband and I were together for about 23 years, and we have three boys. Mm-hmm. And my husband was always relatively healthy, and suddenly he was having trouble eating. He was having trouble keeping food down. So we went to the doctor, and they did a series of tests, and the first series of tests came back, and they said there's something, you know, they did like an endoscopy where they go, you drink something, and they look at the throat and the esophagus, and they said there's something there, so we need to do a little further testing and see what's going on. Well, then the diagnosis came back, esophagus cancer, and, I mean, it was just like unbelievable. We couldn't even believe it. I mean, you don't believe it. Somebody to seemingly be healthy and then next day they can't eat. So this is where basically where the journey began with this diagnosis. My husband was sick 11 months. He was ill 11 months. I took care of him. And it was basically a downward spiral, even though we kept hope that there was some way that he could beat this this diagnosis, even though esophagus cancer for the most part, I mean, I did a ton of research. And the survival rate at last stage, late stage, is pretty dismal. It's like, I don't know, it's less than 10%. I mean, it's pretty scary that the statistics. But even so, he decided not to do chemo radiation, the traditional route, and we decided to do alternative methods in an attempt to, you know, have quality of life and hopefully even to beat this diagnosis. Unfortunately, the end result was that he did pass away 11 months after the diagnosis, and leaving myself and my three children, who at the time were 10, my boys 10, 18, and 19. And basically, this is my story, my children's story. And when I wrote it, it was a very personal journal. It was kind of like a healing for myself. That was my initial idea. And then I just kept getting this idea that other women need to read it. Mm-hmm. And I really didn't want to put it out there because at first, because it is so personal. Mm-hmm. But like I said, this thought was just in my head, other women need to read this. It needs to be shared with other women. So I did decide to put it out there, and that's kind of like where I am today, and I'm still in that process. And it kind of amazes me because, as I was talking to you, Linda, earlier, women have been emailing me and contacting me and just saying, wow, this could be my story. The emotional turmoil, the whole grief process, it's just everybody that contacts me seems to be relating to it. And the book has been getting really good reviews, and it's being received really well. So it just makes me feel good to know that I have put something out there that perhaps is really helping others.
Mm-hmm. And How long did it take them to diagnose his illness?
Well, let's see. From the day what happened was he was throwing up. He was, you know, vomiting a little bit, and he didn't tell me at first. It was just a little bit, and maybe, I don't know, maybe you think your stomach's upset or something. Mm. So I want to say it was within 2 weeks. Mm. A week, he had lost 12 pounds, and that's what he said to me, you know, I don't know what's going on. And I got on the scale, and I lost 12 pounds, and I'm like, 12 pounds? Oh, my gosh, that's scary to lose 12 pounds. Mm. So we went to the doctor. They had the test the next day, the first test. And then the doctor called us in, like, the day after that, and he said, listen, you have to go for other testing, find out what's really going on. And, again, we didn't really think anything serious. You don't with a seemingly healthy person.
Mm-hmm.
And then so it was, like, within a week we knew, from not knowing to knowing.
Mm. And so you initially wrote the book as a form of journaling, really, just to get your own thoughts out on paper. At what point did you realize, or did you decide, that you were actually going to make a book and publish a book?
Well, I started it in the summer. I want to say about 2.5 years after my husband passed away. I started writing because, I've always been a writer, and one day I was like, you know what? There's so much stuff going on in my head. Why don't I just write it down? And it seems like it would help. So I wrote about 20 pages.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, wow, I wrote it all down. I cried when I wrote some of it. And it was just bringing it all up, the whole remembrance. And I'm like, boy, I feel a lot better having written that. And I really kind of thought that was the end of it. And then a couple days later, I started writing some more, and suddenly it's like I have 50 pages, and then over four or five months. By the end of 6 months, I had 200 pages.
Wow.
And it was probably another 6 months before I wrestled with myself, because
mm-hmm.
the thought came immediately after it was done that other women needed to read this. And I'm like, I'm having this conversation in my head, no, this is really personal. I don't want anybody else reading this.
Right.
And I thought I was done, but I wasn't. I was only just beginning.
Well, it's really interesting because last week I was talking to a gentleman called Chris Cade, and he has created a course which he calls Spiritual Growth Writing. And that really kind of started by accident. It was something personal. He started writing just to help himself grow spiritually, and it became something that people are turning to for real spiritual growth. So I think that, you know, this the whole process of writing in that way, it really is a healing thing, and seems to help so many people, I think. You know, for people to be able to write in that way and get it out of their head or get it out of their body is a really healing thing.
I agree, yeah. Because you're, especially if you're doing it without censoring it.
Yes.
You're just putting it down, and the real stuff is coming out. And a lot of the articles I've been writing, I mean, like I wrote an article called A Widow's Many Firsts, and I just wrote it pretty much the first draft right off the cuff without thinking.
Mm-hmm.
I just wrote, I'm just writing down all the things that bothered me and how I felt the first time I went out to lunch by myself. I mean, it seems like such a simple thing, but it was almost kind of like, I guess you'd call stream of consciousness, and I'm just writing, and I wrote the whole thing, and then I left it, and I went back to it about 2 days later, and I looked at it, and I was like, it almost felt foreign. I'm like, I know I wrote this, but I don't know. It's kind of amazing, and a lot of my articles I've done like that, and they seem to be the ones that people really are connecting with.
Right, and I think that's so true. I think when you think about it and try to write from a place of thinking, it doesn't connect with people as much as when you just write, and it just kind of automatic writing, isn't it? It kind of just flows through you, I guess you could say.
Yeah, and it's so authentic to yourself. I mean,
yes.
the ego's not there. You're just putting it out.
Yeah. Now, how old was your husband when he died?
He was 59. He was just shy of his 60th birthday about a week.
Wow. That's pretty young. Tell us about him. What kind of person was he?
Well, he was a very outdoors type person, and he used to, his job pretty much all his life involved running some type of machinery. He was very good at, you know, physical labor, running machines. He worked for the state. And he had been retired approximately, I think, 17 months. I mean, he'd worked all his life. He'd worked since he was like 9 years old. And he worked his whole life. He retired. He was enjoying his retirement. He was still working a little bit on the side here and there. And then suddenly, you know, he got hit with this.
Yeah.
But he was very, it was strange, because it's strange to say upbeat, but he was very, during the illness, I never heard him complain.
Mm-hmm.
And he just, I guess you could say he kind of took it in stride. That's the best way I can describe it.
Yeah. Now, you say in the book that the second 6 months after he passed were more difficult than the first 6 months. Would you share how that was so?
Well, the first 6 months, let's see, it was May when he passed away, and I have a lawn maintenance business, and that, of course, is in, you know, in New York when we're starting to mow lawns and take care of lawns. And what had happened was I was worried about losing my business. I had a pretty good business going, so my oldest son took it over for me so I could, you know, because it starts usually first part of May. And my husband, that was near the end, and he was really sick, and I didn't dare leave him alone at all because I was afraid he would fall or he might need medicine or something. So I was virtually kind of glued to his side the last month. And my son decided that so I didn't lose my accounts, he would, and he wasn't working at the time. He was in between jobs. He decided to take over my business, which worked out really good. Then what happened when my husband passed away, I would start to go on the jobs and help him. He was doing the main stuff, but I would go and maybe help trim, you know, weed trim the lawns or something, but he was basically taking care of it. And then I had to deal with, well, you know, after someone passes away, you have to contact Social Security, and there's death certificates, and the estate with the lawyer, and the health insurance. There were all these little things that had to be seen to, had to be taken. So that, like, occupied my mind. So I would basically fall into bed at night exhausted, and as far as I was concerned, that was great because I didn't have to think. The first 6 months, and it was just like one thing after the other, take care of this. We had car payment, and, you know, we had insurance on the car, and it was supposed to be paid off, and the insurance company was giving us a hard time. So it's just these little things that I had to deal with, and then the insurance bills were still coming in, just the statements, not the bills, but the statements were coming in 6 months after he died because he had been on hospice, and all this stuff was still coming in, and I had to make sure that the things got routed to the right place, I guess you'd say. So I was very occupied with all these little things going on, and then I was very concerned with, okay, I want to make sure I stay on an even keel because I don't want my kids to think I'm cracking up or anything. I want my kids to know that I'm still here and they can depend on me. Again, my boys were 10, 18, and 19. And so it was all that stuff. And then the second 6 months, well, he passed away at the end of May. Our anniversary, wedding anniversary, was actually October. And that was, like, really bad. So you got June, July, August. So that's like 5 or 6 months there, and that was when it started hitting me. And when I say started hitting me, I woke up one day and I was like, oh my God, what am I going to do with the next 40 years of my life?
Yeah.
I was just like at a loss, and I just remember laying there and kind of crying, and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, it's like I don't even know who I am. I had been taking care of him for 11 months, and then suddenly that's gone, and I occupied myself doing all this other stuff, taking care of bills, insurance, whatever. And then suddenly 6 months, things started to slow down. The lawn mowing slowed down. October, pretty much are stopping, October, November. So that was slowing down. So there was less things that I was occupying my mind with. So thoughts started coming in. And then the anniversary, and then you have the first Christmas alone. And it was a very kind of, I guess you'd say, depressing time. And I didn't even realize, I guess, that I was depressed, especially right before Christmas, about a month before Christmas to about 2 weeks after the New Year. I suddenly woke up one morning and I felt pretty good, almost what I want to say kind of normal. And that's when it hit me like, oh, my gosh, I was really depressed. I was going through the motions.
Yeah.
And it's weird because you, when you're in this grief process, you're going through the day and you're like, okay, it's almost bedtime. I can just go to sleep and forget. And then you get up and it's just like you go through the motions, but there's like this numbness attached to everything you're doing. And I remember thinking one time, oh my gosh, what if the rest of my life I stay numb like this? If I have no interest in anything? It was very frightening. I thought, maybe I'm going nuts. Maybe I'll never be normal again. I'll never have a normal life again where I feel joy. And it's not to say I didn't feel any joy, but for the most part, it was gone.
Wow. Now, in the book, you talk in a lot of detail about his illness. Was that important to remember and to tell others about some of those specifics? I know that most often people don't want to remember the details. So was that important to you?
I guess it must have been because at the time when he was sick, I did not write anything down. I know some people do that and that helps them, but I had no, my brain was just so focused on his well-being and his next medicine and the schedule. I kept charts. I kept exact charts of every single thing I gave him, whether it was because he had a stomach tube, whether it was in the stomach tube or orally pain medicine or pain patches, whatever. But as far as writing anything down, I didn't. And then when I started doing this about 2.5 years, I was amazed at the memory recall that I did have. And I guess in a way I wanted to let other people know that there are other ways than the traditional chemo and radiation. And and that might be why I initially, you know, included some of that stuff. Because even though, you know, he passed away, his quality of life, I am convinced, was so much better than if he had allowed them to do the chemo and radiation.
Right. And you did face some criticism from family and friends even, didn't you, because
of
that decision?
Yeah, it was very difficult because, in fact, that was one of the articles I also had written about was, you know, medical decisions are personal decisions.
Yeah.
And you might not agree with what someone's doing, but you know what? At the time, we did the best we could with the knowledge that we had.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just, you know, there were some things. I mean, there was a lot more that we did that I didn't put in the book.
Mm-hmm.
But the U.S. is very kind of strict, too, about certain things that you can and cannot do. The alternative medicine, the FDA or whatever, American Medical Association, there are some things that they don't know the true extent of how some of this may or may not work, so they really frown on it. And I basically left some stuff out because I just felt like, you know what, I don't want to put myself on the line.
Right. No, I understand that, yeah. It has to be one of the hardest things not only to lose a loved one but to watch them deteriorate over time. It must be just a very powerless feeling.
Yeah, it was incredibly difficult, and I especially really, really felt bad for my boys because they saw their father in this decline, and almost, when I look at it now, I mean, we always had hope, but when I look back now, it's like, you know what? It was really a runaway train from the beginning. It was all a downward spiral. And, you know, we had the hope going, and when we just, and you can't give up hope. I don't know. Some people say maybe you're in denial or whatever. But I don't know. My thought is you have to keep hope, at least to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when it hits you in the face that, okay, there really is no more hope, then you have to face it then and deal with it. But I just couldn't give up hope that somehow something would happen, something would work, that, you know, he would get better.
Right. And how did your children cope? Did they all cope with it quite differently?
Well, you know, it's hard to tell as far as when it was going on.
Mm.
It was more afterwards when I see how my children reacted in their three of them, totally different ways. When it was going on, the kids were incredibly supportive. My youngest used to, if my husband was moving from one room to another, he would carry his feeding pump. It was like on a thing that had wheels. Or he'd carry, it sounds nasty, but he had a bucket beside him all the time because he vomited all the time. He couldn't keep anything down. And my middle son and my oldest son would go to the pharmacy and pick up medications for my husband, or if they were out somewhere, they would call and ask if there was anything we needed before they came home. Like at the health food store, I got a lot of stuff from the health food store, supplements and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But they were always very conscious of thinking of their father, and me also, because they were saving me a trip into town. So they'd always call and say, you know, is there anything you need? It was afterwards, when my husband passed away, that my kids had really different reactions in their grief process. My youngest son, who was not quite 11, he was a couple months shy of 11, he clung to me like he was 3 or 4. I mean, he hung on me, and he was always with me, and he always had his arm around me, which was fine. I understood.
Mm-hmm.
I understood that he was afraid, and he even put that into words one time, and he said to me, you know, what happens if you die? What's going to happen? And it's strange, too, but for a while, I had a fear very early on after my husband died. I had a fear that, oh, my gosh, what happens if I get sick and die? My kids won't have anybody. I mean, they have my parents, but it's not the same as a parent. They had their grandparents. So I just tried to reassure him and tell him, you know, nobody knows what's going to happen, but I said, I'm really healthy, and I plan to live a long time. I have a lot of stuff I want to do yet. But I told him, if anything ever were to happen, you know, your aunt would take care of you, or grandma and grandpa. And, you know, that was all I could tell him, but it seemed to reassure him. My middle son, he started missing classes. He wouldn't go to work. He wanted to stay in bed all day. And I tried to talk to him about being depressed or anything he wanted to talk to me about. And he said, no, everything's fine. And he wouldn't share. I mean, I could get him to talk once in a while. And I tried to get the kids to go for counseling, but they were so totally adamant they were not going to talk to anyone else. My oldest son, shortly after his father moved away, he got a job in another town, and he ended up moving out. And I was incredibly worried about him because I just had this feeling in my heart that he was running wild. And he probably was. But you know what? It's 19, and you can talk to your kids so much, and the rest is up to them. And I just let him know that I loved him, I supported him. He had car accidents, and he had all kinds of stuff going on, and it was just really heartbreaking to witness this, you know, and try to support him, but at the same time saying, "Come on, think about what you're doing. You're not making very good choices."
Yeah.
So, you know, they all had different reactions, and I mean, I've read a lot about when kids lose their parents, kind of in an effort to maybe educate myself. I mean, I could see what was going on, but I wanted to know if maybe there was something more I could do, something behind the behavior that maybe I could help with. So the effect of children losing their fathers, it can be, you know, there can be ramifications for many years down the road. It depends on the kid. I guess just like with adults, there could be ramifications. I know some people think you get over grief, like, you know, a year goes by, and I mean, that's the traditional thinking. So I think people are smarter now, but a lot of people still think, okay, it's been a year, you know, pull yourself together, get over it, move on with life. And that's, for the most part, that's not what happens.
No, and it's interesting, you think people really do still feel that way.
Yes.
For the most part, yeah.
And I've had, yes, I've had widows contact me and say, you know what, I feel so bad because my best friend says, you know what, it's been a year, you've done the grief thing, now get over it, get out. And
wow.
And maybe they're not trying to be insensitive, but they are really being insensitive to someone saying that. You know, everybody's grief process is different. It's individual. Overall, it's the same, but each person has their own individual process they have to go through.
Yes. Hmm. Definitely. And is there a reason, you think, why none of your boys wanted to go and talk to anybody else, didn't want any kind of grief counseling or anything like that?
I don't know. They're very very independent thinkers, kind of like myself. But I try, because hospice offers, they have like counseling, so much counseling, whatever, you know, after you lose someone. And I really wanted them to go for that, but they were just, no. And short of putting them in the car, which even my 10-year-old, putting him in the car, I don't know.
Oh, dear. Now, you said in the book that you worked on yourself spiritually, mentally, physically. What kinds of things did you do to help yourself?
Well, I've always kind of skirted with meditation. I've always kind of been in and out of it. But I really started doing a lot more meditation, just trying to find some kind of inner peace. I went to I think she was a psychologist. But anyway, we tried, she gave me we talked, and she gave me a tape of like self-empowerment. And again, it was kind of like a meditation-based thing that I would do when I was feeling distressed. I went and talked to, when my oldest son was having accidents, I was really totally stressed out, and I went to see a psychologist just to talk and just figure out how I could deal with this anxiety I felt. And actually, I only went 3 or 4 times to him. I just didn't, I don't know, I felt like he didn't get it. And I really didn't care for him. So I'm like, okay, this counseling thing isn't for me. But then about 6 months later, I think, I found a woman counselor that I went to, and I really, really liked her. And I felt that I really connected with her, and she helped me work through some of the issues I was still dealing with as far as the aloneness and feeling lonely and, you know, anxiety issues, which had changed by that time. But still, I went to her, I think I went to her for a month or 2 months or so, and it was nice just to go and just talk. Sometimes that's all I wanted to do was just talk, and I guess just kind of get reassurance that I wasn't crazy. It was normal what I was feeling. And that really helped. And then physically, I really started doing a lot of, I've always been a walker, but I really started doing a lot more hiking, getting outside, and I started doing things like kayaking, which I really come to love. And I really got outside more, and being outside, being on a lake, being in the woods, I don't know, there's just like, for me, there's a calming factor to it,
mm-hmm.
and it kind of stills a lot of the mind chatter that goes on. And I also started biking, and I mean, I took classes and stuff. I started taking dance lessons, so I was really trying to do things that I had been interested in but had never really pursued. I hadn't pursued in quite a while. So in that way, that's how I was working on myself, expanding, you know, kind of my database of activity. And some of it in the beginning might have been, again, just to kind of take up my mind time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But, I mean, a lot of this stuff I still do because I just enjoy it, like cross-country ski and snowshoe and, you know, stuff like that.
Well, and I think you're right. Just being out in nature, I think, does have a very healing and calming effect.
Yeah.
You also mentioned in the book that one of the things that you're doing is making an extra effort to take care of yourself and your health. What kinds of things are you doing for your health? You talk a lot about natural health in the book, and so you're following a lot of that for yourself.
Yeah, because when my husband was sick, I did a lot of research. And I've never really been too interested in alternative modalities, alternative, you know, health doctors. But after doing all this research, I was really interested in it. And after, I want to say about 2 months after my husband passed away, I was having, I guess I was perimenopausal. That's the way they describe it. I was having hot flashes. I was waking up at night 6 or 7 times a night. I was having trouble sleeping. The way my doctor, my naturopathic doctor who I hooked up with, explained it to me was, you know, for 11 months, my adrenaline was basically on call all the time. I was taking care of my husband. If he needed anything, I would immediately, you know, take care of it and making sure the kids were okay. And I was always on call. I was always, mm-hmm. that's an awful way to say it, but my system felt like it was always on call. So I was always ready to, at the drop of a hat, to do whatever I had to do. And then suddenly, you know, I'm not doing that anymore, but my adrenaline is still going, even though things changed. He had passed away. So it was kind of like, I guess, adrenal burnout, and my thyroid, there was issues going on with that, and I had gained weight, and I couldn't lose weight, and I had bought a treadmill, and I was using that to try to, I think I had gained 12 or 15 pounds, and I felt really uncomfortable, and I just felt really kind of terrible with all this lack of sleep and waking up and these heart palpitations. So I went, I contacted actually a doctor that I had gone to a class at a local college. He had given a class on women's hormones and, you know, menopause, and that's kind of like his specialty. So I contacted him. He's about an hour away from me, and I said, I'd really like to see you to try, you know, get myself on track. My system is all out of whack, totally out of whack. So we made an appointment, and the thing is with alternative med doctors, you figure the first appointment is usually an hour and a half, 2 hours. It's not
mm-hmm.
a 10-minute in and out.
Right.
The thing about alternative med doctors that I absolutely love, which can be excruciating, but I love it, you go and you talk to him, and they want to know what's going on in your life. They don't want to know just about your symptoms. They want to know basically your history, what's going on emotionally, what events led up to this, what do you think about this, that. And it basically, I kind of equate it to, you know, ripping your guts out.
Right, and that's because it's a holistic approach, and anything that's going on in your life is having an impact on your health, so they need to know about it, right?
Yes. And that, you know, and I absolutely love my naturopathic doctor, but what ended up happening is he did kind of his assessment, and it was kind of interesting to watch him work because he does it intuitively also,
mm-hmm.
the supplements and whatnot that he recommends for you. And basically, I think he gave me some B vitamins and some different oils in capsule format and some magnesium, and he gave me different supplements, and he said, you know, it's probably going to take I don't know. He said probably going to take about 4 or 5 months before, you know, your system will get straightened out. But he said, I want to touch base with you, you know, at the end of the month. Let me know if anything's changed, if you have any other concerns. And then we set up an appointment after that. So within, I want to say, about a month, month and a half, I had started losing weight. And my system was back on track. I was sleeping at night. I no longer had the heart palpitations. It's like things were slowing down to a normal instead of that frenzied adrenaline rushing through my body. Mm-hmm. And within 2 months, you know, I'd had my period all the time almost, and everything seemed to be falling into place, which I was so glad because it was like, you know, it's like a light bulb burning out. That's what I felt like. And I called him up and I said, I know you said, you know, 4 or 5 months or something. I said, but you know what? Things are really, and he was even surprised that, you know, it had happened that quickly. And I've been working with him on and off for about 4 years. We keep an eye on my thyroid because I do have thyroid in my family. And we did have, let's see, so he has me do blood work like once a year. Of course, I have to go to the regular doctor because in New York State, a naturopathic doctor, unless he is also an MD, cannot order blood tests. So I go to my regular doctor, and he knows I go to both doctors. And they ordered the blood work, and it turned out my thyroid was elevated. And they said, well, it looks like you're hyperactive. So the regular doctor said, go to an endocrinologist. So I talked to my naturopathic doctor, and he said, yeah. He said, that's a good idea. See what he says. So long story short, the regular doctor, the endocrinologist, wanted to put me on Synthroid or something. And I said, listen, I prefer to do things alternative medicine if I possibly can. I said, I don't have any symptoms. It's just that my blood work came back strange, so I would rather wait. And he's like, well, you can wait, but, you know, it could happen any time. You'll be in distress and, you know, blah, blah. So he said, all right. He said, in 6 months, come back. We'll keep an eye on it. He said, but don't do anything in the meantime. In other words, basically he said to me, don't do anything with your alternative med doctor.
Mm.
So I said, yeah, okay, whatever. So I brought the test results to my alternative med doctor, and he gave me different supplements, and within 6 months I went back, had another blood work, went to the endocrinologist, and he just kind of looked at me and he says, your numbers are all normal. I said, oh, that's good. He said, yeah. But he said, you know, that could change at any time. I said, okay. Well, what I found interesting was he didn't want to know what I'd been doing to get my numbers normal.
Right.
Because obviously I wasn't on a prescription or anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just find that interesting that you'd think, you know, a doctor's main concern is for you to be well, and I always feel that they should be open to anything that's going to help you.
You would think
seem
so.
Like they are. Mm-hmm. You would think so. Okay, so in the book you talk about when you felt ready for another relationship and starting to date again. Would you tell us a little bit about that, how you felt and how you got back into dating again?
Well, I decided about a year after my husband's passing that I would really like to start dating again. My social life was pretty much non-existent, and I thought it would be nice to, you know, start going out socially. At the time, I thought I was ready, but of course, it took me another year and a half to realize at that time, I was, like, so unready to date. It wasn't funny. I mean, thinking I was ready, thinking I wasn't needy, thinking everything was going to be okay, I was pretty needy, not okay, emotionally unavailable, because all I was trying to do was fill up the loneliness. I thought I was ready for a relationship, but I was just incredibly lonely. And I think from my own experience, until you somehow, until you fix that loneliness inside you, until you're happy with who you are by yourself,
mm-hmm.
then in all fairness, you can't bring someone else into your life. And that's
right.
what I've learned.
That is so true. That is so true. And, you know, people so often are looking for somebody else to fill up that void, to stop them feeling lonely. But what they don't realize is that they have to fill that void themselves. They have to overcome the loneliness themselves before they're even ready for a relationship.
Right. And I didn't know that. I
mm-hmm.
thought I was ready. But in hindsight, I mean, I was just incredibly lonely. I mean, you're used to having someone in your life for 20 years or more. I came from a big family. I've always been around people. And my kids were home. But, you know, the kids get older. They have their own friends, their own stuff that they do. And it's not the same anyway. And I remember thinking, there's nobody there to share this with. There's nobody that cares that I did this today, or, you know, who's going to care? I mean, it's just that feeling of that big void that I am totally on my own.
Right. That's quite a realization, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
It is. And, again, you know, I went into the dating thing thinking I was ready, and I decided to try online dating, which at the time I remember thinking, oh, my gosh. Online dating. What will people think if they know I'm online dating? I mean, it was a totally new idea to me. I hadn't regular dated in, like, I don't know, 26 years.
I can't imagine, you know, just going back into that just must be very, very difficult.
It is,
very
yeah.
difficult. Yeah. You said in the book that you discovered emotions that you had kept hidden from yourself. What kind of emotions? Well, tell us a little bit about that.
I remember at one point, I'm trying to think when it was, maybe 2 years or so after my husband passed away, I discovered that one day that I was so incredibly mad. I was so angry. I was so furious with my husband for leaving us.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, it kind of made me feel guilty, but I'm like, I couldn't get over it. I was, like, incredibly furious that he left us. He left me. He left the kids when they needed him the most, boys. And it just like, slammed me in the back of the head one day how absolutely furious I was. And I didn't even realize it just suddenly, like, surfaced. And I'm like, wow, where did that come from? And I tried to process it, you know, outside of feeling guilty. I tried to process it and say, well, okay, maybe I have a right to be angry, because who expects at 46, 47 to suddenly be on your own, raising three boys? And not that he chose to get sick and die, but in a way, that's how I was looking at it. He made the choice to get sick, and he died, and he left us. And that's, I mean, all kinds of crazy thoughts were going through my head, and it just added, it just fueled the anger that, you know, he left us.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Now, you said that your writing had been affected. Would you tell us more about that? So your writing was affected from the whole process, from his illness and his passing?
Yeah, I had been published in women's fiction before my husband, let's see, 2 years before my husband got ill.
Mm-hmm.
And as often happens in publishing houses, they assign me a new editor. And I went from an editor who really liked my writing to an editor who didn't care for my writing. So I was kind of like in a holding stage. I had submitted several different things, and she kept rejecting. So that's what kind of like where I was at when my husband got sick. And then once he got sick, I totally didn't do any writing at all until the journal. And when I started journaling, that was a way that I kind of started writing. But it was still almost like pulling teeth to, you know, put this stuff down on paper. And I couldn't find any interest in writing anything. There were no ideas coming, anything else. There were no ideas coming. And it just kind of felt like a void, which was kind of scary because, I mean, I've been writing since I was like 9 or 10 years old. And then to have nothing there, just to have this big empty space.
Right.
And it really worried me because, you know, that's kind of like how I define myself. I'm a writer. And if a writer can't write. So that lasted, I want to say, until about, I mean, I did the book, but any other writing was pretty much, you know, by the wayside. It just wasn't happening. Until about a year ago is when I really started writing again. And the thing that I started writing about were articles in relation to my experience, loss, grief, bereavement. And to go from not being able to write, and then suddenly from January to May of last year, I wrote 40 articles.
Wow.
800 to 1,000 words each article. And I started putting them out on different article sites, and I started a blog, which a year ago I didn't even know what a blog was. And I didn't know what social networking was about, so I got on Facebook and MySpace, and now my name is kind of like all over the place, and my articles are all over the place. So I had planned out this whole scenario where, okay, I searched for my name back in December, about a year ago, and of course there was nothing. There's another Elaine Williams, she's an actress. But basically there was nothing at all in relation to my name. So my plan was, okay, I want to get these articles out there. I want to get name recognition. And in turn, that will hopefully get the book out to women who need to read it or anyone else who needs to read it. So that's been the game plan. And along the way, the book came out in June. And actually, I got some really good reviews. And USA Book News, it just finaled in the health, death, and dying category.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's all a means for, you know, based on my original thought of getting it into the hands of those who really need to see it.
Right.
So that's where we're going.
Right, and you mentioned in the book that there was a movie that you saw that helped to rekindle your passion for writing. What was that movie?
It was one of the Bourne Identity, the most recent one, and I had never seen any of the other ones, and it really brought home to me this, it was like, if you've ever seen any of those, it's like one thing after the other, and it keeps your interest.
Yes.
And I was like, oh my gosh, that's what I want to get back again, where I have those ideas, and it's just one thing after the other, and it's, you know, when I had been published in women's fiction, I mean, that book, they put it with a special promotion, and it was in a promotion with four other books, a special promotion, and I had gone to a book signing, and I had an editor from the publishing house come up to me and say how they were talking about my book, and it was, you know, and that's what I wanted back again. I wanted that fire to put those words on paper again and have it really mean something instead of being stuck, you know?
Yeah.
And after
yeah.
I saw that movie, I was like, oh, my gosh, that's what I want back. I want that, you know, those ideas, one right after the other. And it just sparked something in me, I guess. And actually, after I saw that, I wrote a screenplay.
Did you?
Basically on the book, yes.
Oh, wow.
I've also played with scripts a little bit.
Uh-huh. That really did get you back into the flow of writing, didn't it? That's great.
Oh, it was amazing. And I actually wrote the first draft of the script in a week, which really kind of blew my mind.
Wow. What would you say you have learned? I'm sure you've learned a lot of things, but what would you say is the main thing that you've learned from what you've gone through?
Well, if I were to, if anyone in the grief process were to ask me, I would say that, you know what, time is always on your side. And when you're growing through the grief process, sometimes your life is up, sometimes it's down, sometimes it's totally turned lopsided. And that's normal. And, you know, you can't beat yourself up because one day maybe all you get done is the dishes in the sink and you don't get anything else done. You just have to let time work through you, let it bring you on this journey. I mean, I'm the first person that gets impatient. I want things done yesterday. I wanted the grief, I wanted it done. I wanted it out of my life. But you can't rush it. You can't rush it. And when the emotions rise, the best thing I can say is you have to face them and I guess really feel them so that you can get through them and, you know, get rid of, get through the process. But time is really important, and don't rush. I think the worst thing I did was I tried to rush some of these processes. And I learned from it. I mean, I wouldn't change anything. I learned from all of it. But sometimes I wish it had been a little easier.
Right. Well, and that was my next question. Is there anything that you would do differently now if you had the chance?
A couple of the dating experiences, I wish I had handled them differently. But then again, I think, well, maybe if I hadn't, I wouldn't have learned what I've learned. I wouldn't have grown, you know, I mean, it sounds a little silly, but I wouldn't have grown that much more because I think I had to go through what I went through to get where I am today.
Right. Well, yeah, absolutely, and I think that's true for all of us. And I think the mistake that people very often make is that they think, you know, life has its ups and downs, and it's always going to be that way. Sometimes things will go really well, and sometimes you'll be in a real crisis. But I think for some reason we feel perhaps that the crises shouldn't happen or the bad stuff shouldn't happen. It should all be, it's all supposed to be wonderful all the time, which of course it never is. And that's very unrealistic. And but it's those difficult times that we really learn from, and that's when we really grow.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's what makes us who we are.
That's when you're tested.
Yes.
And, you know, you take away, I think you take away with you from every experience, good and bad, but especially the ones that are really hard, I mean, they really stick with you. You don't forget them.
Right, absolutely. Definitely. Well, and what would you say, if there is one thing that you could pick, what would you say is the most difficult thing for you through all this?
Was learning to be with myself, because I had actually never done that.
Right.
I had always lived with family, or I had been married. I had never been tested to the point where, okay, can I make a living on my own? Can I support myself and my kids? Can I be happy by myself if that's the space I'm at right now? And that was the hardest lesson that I've had to learn, was to be happy with myself, totally.
Mm. And I think that's something we all need to pay attention to, no matter what our life situation is, no matter if we're surrounded by people or if we're on our own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. So if you were talking to someone who was going through a similar experience to you, what piece of advice would you most want to give them?
I guess don't be too hard on yourself. Because a lot of times when you're going through this grief process, you're second-guessing your decisions. There's going to be a lot of things that you're going to do for the first time by yourself. And don't beat yourself up if you're afraid.
Mm.
Because that fear factor might enter, because you're going down a new road, and change is a lot of times change is scary. But I don't know, I guess the thing is you have to remain open to life, as hard as it is sometimes. Don't close yourself off and, you know, allow yourself to, like, be closed off by bitterness or anger. I mean, it's okay to experience that anger, to work through it, but don't let it take hold of your life. You know, don't let it continue. Eventually, if you remain open to living, you will feel joy again. You will resume a new normal. It doesn't have to be the old normal, because you've gone through a change. You've lost a spouse. You've lost a loved one. There is going to be change. And as hard as it is to embrace sometimes, you never know what waits on the other side of the fence.
Right.
Be something really great.
That's great advice. That's very good advice. Well, I just want to, let's see if there's anybody who's on the line who may have a question. Does anybody want to ask Elaine a question? Give a minute for that. Okay, well then the next thing we need to do is to tell everybody how they can get hold of a copy of the book. And for everybody listening to this who's a member on my site, I'll be putting a link to the book with the recording so you can find the book. But the book is called A Journey Well Taken, Life After Loss by Elaine Williams. And definitely available online. Is it available in bookstores generally?
Well, you can go to Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble or online bookstores. You can also go into a regular bookstore and request it by the name of the book and the title and the author. You can order it off of my website, ajourneywelltaken.com. So there's several different avenues that you can order the book.
Right. Well, thank you so much, first of all, for writing the book, because I think this, you know, as people have already shared with you, I think it's so valuable for people to read someone's personal experience. I think that is very, very helpful for people. And thank you also for talking with me this evening and sharing more, more detail about.
I really enjoyed speaking with you. And again, I appreciate the opportunity that, you know, that you've allowed me to come on here and speak about the book.
Well, this, I think it's a difficult subject. It's something that, you know, not everybody wants to talk about or feels able to talk about. And I think the fact that you not only are willing to do that, but you do that so well is just incredibly helpful for so many people. So thank you, Elaine.
Thank you.
All right. I'll say good night.
Good night.
Good night.
The moderator has disconnected. The call will now end.